Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Welcome. And, well, rolling out the red carpet for you tonight. We have a great show. We're going to be talking a little bit about a lot of things. The 7:30 hour, we're going to be talking to Jill O'Brien about sexual harassment. And I know we've heard a lot about sexual harassment and Me Too and all of that. But what we're going to do is we're going to take some scenarios that may be familiar to you in the workplace and see if we can figure out whether that's sexual harassment or not. A lot of people are interested in where the line gets drawn, and I'll be asking if you have any questions on that topic. And then at the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to be taking legal questions from you for the next hour. Sometime in that last hour, we are going to be talking to the lawyers who represented the victims of a terrible car crash that was caused by a drunk off-duty police officer. And the question is going to be, why did the city of Chicago have to pay $20 million to settle a case for a cop who was off duty at the time of the negligence? A very interesting question that a lot of people are asking. Let me give out the numbers here. If anyone has any comments or questions at any time, we'd love to hear from you. 312-981-7200, or text to that same number, 312-981-7200. But we're going to start with a little something that I did this morning. And this morning was a very special morning because it was really nice out, but the water in Lake Michigan was really cold, and I plunged into it. Yes, I did. I was in the polar plunge for Special Olympics, and I want to talk a little bit to some of the people who made it happen and made it possible. I'm going to... joining me to talk about it is Ann Burke. Justice Ann Burke is the originator, the founder of Special Olympics. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Well, good evening, Karen. I'm glad you were able to jump out of the lake in one piece.
My feet are still cold. I don't know about yours.
But yes, my whole body is still cold.
I am still cold. And also joining us is Drew Burlak, who has worked tirelessly for 20 years, has been the past president of Special Olympics in Chicago, and is now the treasurer. Hi, Drew. Welcome.
Hi, Karen. Great to be with you. Justice Burke, good to hear from you again. Hope you all both had a good time this morning at the plunge.
It was
really, we sure did, Drew.
It was fun. I mean, if anyone is, as if you've never been there and you say to yourself, this is not something I'm interested in, it's really fun. I mean, there's the hoopla festivities. There's people dressed in costumes. There are people from the television shows in Chicago being filmed. There are stretchers. There are all kinds of things going on. But let's talk a little bit about, I'm going to kind of go back and forth with some of the Special Olympics, what's going on, and the polar plunge. And a lot of people hear that Eunice Shriver Kennedy was the originator of the Special Olympics, but truly, you were the one who came up with this idea in 1968, which was 50 years ago this year. Tell me the situation that caused you to come up with this great idea to have Special Olympics for kids with disabilities.
Sure, Karen. First of all, our program for the Chicago Park District began in 1965 when I was the physical education teacher teaching kids with disabilities then. And over the next couple of years, 65, 66, and 67, it became very clear that once someone, these children and adults learned a skill, they were quite good at it. And so we started having competition at our park at West Pullman on the southeast side. And also, there were nine other parks in the city. The president of the park district at the time was Bill McFetridge, and the vice president, Dan Shannon. They came out to the park, they saw the kids, first time they ever saw them, and they were amazed at their abilities. And they said, well, how many kids like this are in Chicago? And it's, you know, in 1967, 60, that we had no clue, because most of the time children with disabilities were either in institutions or in closets in their home. But at least we had some parents and others around the city that brought their kids out. So having a citywide track meet was something that Park District does all the time with all the day camps at that time. And I thought we'd have one for our kids. So I wrote to Mrs. Shriver and told her what we were going to do in Chicago. She liked the idea. She asked me to write a proposal, in which I did, and she said, well, this isn't big enough. It has to be national. She says, you come back, write a national proposal, and we'll help you. So that's exactly what happened. So I had the idea, and she had $25,000. So
it was a good combination.
It was a good combination. However, you were absolutely correct. Eunice Kennedy Shriver, after our first Chicago Special Olympics in July 1968, saw what was happening, saw the energy and the electricity with these kids, the volunteers, and their parents, finally understanding that their kids could do things, decided to make a national program for every state. So she took the idea from Chicago and brought it to the rest of the country, and now it's in 172 countries.
Drew, can you talk a little bit about having been involved in the Chicago branch of this great organization for a long time? Tell me the numbers of people, of kids who participate in these programs, both here and nationally.
Yeah, so here in Chicago, we've got about 7,500 athletes. We do about 22 different sporting events throughout the year. You know, we're a partnership between the Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Park District. So many, all of our athletes either work out of a park program or work out of a Chicago Public School. So we've got an amazing group of people at both CPD and CPS who are the coaches for the athletes. And so we are the largest, we're the largest area in Illinois, and we're actually, the Chicago program is actually larger than 26 states in the country.
So just so we can put this, the definition of what Special Olympics really is, it's for kids with mental disabilities. And what kind of kids are we talking about? Shirley Down syndrome children, is that correct?
Yeah, so, you know, yes, exactly. So it's individuals with mental disabilities. And yes, you know, Down syndrome is an example. We have many children, you know, with autism and other disabilities. But what I think what's great about the program is, you know, we even have a program starting now for the younger athletes. But I think what Justice Burke can even talk about a little bit is we still have athletes involved that participated in our 50th games back in 1968.
Yes. In fact, I'm going to talk a little bit about the powerlifting competition. Justice Burke asked me to get involved and see what it was like firsthand to be involved in one of these sessions where they then advance to the next level. And so last weekend, I was at the powerlifting competition at Quest Gym on the West Side, and it was so amazing to see these kids. They had trained really hard. They were in great shape, and they were doing powerlifting, and their form was great, and they were so excited. Their parents were there. They were just kind and wonderful. And I have to tell you, if you could harness that energy in that room and sell it, you'd be a millionaire. But thank you for inviting me, and I just can't say enough about that experience. You know, I guess I'd like to know how often do these kids train, Drew? Do they train on a daily basis?
Yeah, for the most part, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, there's 22 events. Not every athlete participates in all 22 events. You know, so I mean, obviously the athletes kind of pick and choose what they like to do. You know, a lot of the different park programs, you know, kind of stress maybe some of the other ones over others. But at the end of the day, you know, if an athlete wants to participate in any of the 22 events that we provide, obviously they have the ability to do it. You know, and between May 7th and May 11th, we're going to be having, which is what I think most people, you know, Special Olympics about is our spring games. You know, so on May 7th, we're going to have opening ceremonies at Soldier Field, which is on a Monday, and then the rest of the week will be at Dunbar Park. But I would say, in general, we probably have close to 5,000 athletes that participate in our spring games.
Absolutely amazing. Can you hold with me while we go to break, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more?
Sounds great.
All right. Amazing. You're listening to WGN. It's the Karen Conti Show.
You're as cold as ice. You're willing to sacrifice our love.
And we were not cold this morning. Actually, we were not cold until we got in that water, and then it was cold. Ann Burke, Justice Ann Burke, and Drew Burlap from the Special Olympics are with me tonight talking about the Polar Plunge and about the 50th anniversary of Special Olympics. And I want to talk to you a little bit about going back to 1968, and you talked a little bit about how things were different with disabled children. Can you kind of give us an idea of what the climate was like there politically, what the climate was like for these kids, and how you think the Special Olympics really has changed all of that in the last 50 years?
Well, Karen, that's a terrific question, because if you put your mind and think about 1965, children and adults with mental disabilities, actually, you never saw them. They were in institutions, or they were in someone's home, and there was an aura of embarrassment. Even doctors and medical people would say if a child was born and had a mental disability, a developmental disability, they were told to put the child in an institution. And a lot of parents actually did that. So generally speaking, the general public really never had access, exposure to these individuals. And even within families, extended family members never really knew that a child was disabled in another part of the family's member. So given that, no one knew anything about people with disabilities. Our Park District, the Chicago Park District, was asked to put a program together by the Kennedy Foundation in 65 just to experiment using public facilities, the first in the world, really, public facilities for people with disabilities. There were a lot of questions. What will happen when people see my child who acts different, looks different? Will they be bullied? Will people be ostracized them? And a little bit of that did happen, but very little, because people started to realize that kids were kids. If you threw a ball, they wanted to play ball with you. But they just didn't have the skills. So what we have now and has happened in the last 50 years with the Chicago Park District is inclusion. The siblings and the cousins and members of the park all helped with the kids. So I think over the 50 years, it's just second nature now. We see, we're not afraid. We know what people with disabilities are, who they are, that they're individuals. They're contributing members of our society. They work. They live independently, many of them, and functioning members of society. So we don't have any inhibitions anymore about people with mental disabilities. But it did take quite some time for that to take hold. If you ask any kid today who's 13, they know everything about kids with special needs because they have them in their classes at school.
Mainstream, right. And that used to never happen, right.
No, because there was no education for people with disabilities prior to the 1970s.
Drew, how did you get involved in Special Olympics? You're a banker by trade, and you really have immersed yourself, literally, this morning, but in this whole Special Olympics deal. It must be rewarding for you, but how did you get involved?
Sure. 1999, I was actually working at LaSalle Bank, that used to be obviously a very large institution here in Chicago, and LaSalle Bank was a wonderful sponsor of Special Olympics, and of course being a banker, I'm also an avid golfer, and so I actually started at the golf competition in 1999. I was a caddy and scorekeeper for an athlete by the name of Charles McDaniels. And that was kind of my first event that I did, that I volunteered at. And actually, Charles and I have been doing that event every year since then. And then 17 years ago, I actually took over the powerlifting event that you attended last week, and I've been doing that for 17 years. And just kind of my involvement on the volunteerism side of it, I got to know a lot of the folks at the Park District, especially Jerry Hennigan, and she really encouraged me if I could want to do more to join the board, and I did. And I'm a past president, and as you know, I've been the treasurer for about 9 years.
So, Drew, I have to say, volunteerism is great. It's wonderful. A lot of people think they don't have time for it or they don't have the energy for it. But let me tell you, I think that this is a type of event that I'm going to attend every year until I can't anymore because of the energy and the positive stuff going on, and I'm going to make time to do that. And I hope I'll be welcome to do that. And I guess I want to open this up for anyone else who might want to volunteer. How could people get involved, Drew?
Sure. You know, for the Chicago program, again, we do 22 events around the city all year long. And if you go to our website, which is sochicago.org, we have a calendar of events, and we have the contact information for anybody that would love to volunteer. Because I agree with you. I think sometimes people are a little hesitant. They don't know what they're going to get into. But when you actually go and you see the energy and you volunteer for one of these events, you just want to do more. And so, again, we've got 22 events, and sochicago.org is the place to go to get that information.
Thank you, Drew. Justice Burke, what's been very interesting is this, because the 50th year is coming up and it's the anniversary and it focuses late on Chicago and your founding of the Special Olympics, we know that there's a movie being made about your concept and how it was in 68, and it's going to follow the story of how you got the Kennedys involved. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, I have to say, Karen, you've caught the bug. It's a contagious affection, isn't it?
It is.
For the Special Olympics.
It is.
Yes, they're doing a film. Actually, Matt Weiner was a script writer, and he used to work and volunteer for Special Olympics out in California as a teacher. And it kind of caught him, and he decided he wanted to do a story about how anybody who has an idea, no matter who they are, we should never discourage them. We should always encourage them to do something, because here was an idea. Actually, I was 23 years old at the time, and no college degree. And it happened. People helped me. They mentored me. And look where it is today. Obviously, Mrs. Shriver was the one who took it worldwide. But it started here in Chicago with just a little bit of an idea, track meet for people with disabilities. And I think the whole point of the film is to encourage people to, if they have an idea, to follow that dream and don't be discouraged, because you never know. That's how things happen, and it could change the world, just like the Special Olympics movement did. It actually changed the world. I know I can remember sitting in Shanghai when the International Games were out there several years ago, and here I was sitting in the third world country watching the president of China with a lot of his officials watch 8,000 people with disabilities from all around the world march into their stadium. And that was when it really hit me, that yes, indeed, a third world country now is celebrating people with disabilities because they have abilities. So that's really kind of when it hit me that this was just a small idea that could change the world.
Thank you so much for joining us. Justice Ann Burke, thank you. And Drew Burlak, thank you so much, and we'll see you next year.
Oh, yes, before that, in July.
Oh, yes, in July, the 50th anniversary. I'll be there. I'll be there.
Okay.
Thank you so much. You're listening to WGN and the Karen Conti Show. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. Sexual harassment has been probably the biggest legal and social issue in this country for months, beginning largely with the Harvey Weinstein scandal. I wonder what he's doing tonight. Giving rise to exposure in Hollywood and in corporate America and television and really all over. Tonight, one of the city's leading employment lawyers is here, Jill O'Brien, who is a partner at Lehner Muchen and a professor of employment discrimination at Loyola School of Law. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So nice to have you here. So this is a big is this as big as we think it is? I mean, it just seems to me that there's a big turnaround right now in the last 6 months when it comes to, and I'll say women in the workplace, but it goes both ways, as we know. Is this as big as a deal as we think it is?
Fortunately, yes, it is that big. And I think it's important to know there's not a change in the law. There's
no.
The law is alive and well. It's a matter of how people are dealing with it. And I think this whole Hollywood movement has really caused people to feel free to talk about it more. And it is that big. It is on everyone's minds.
Now, going forward, how do you envision, and you represent a lot of employers, and you represent big business, and so you have issues, and you have to do investigations into this conduct. And just, how do you see this affecting corporate America long-term? When I say long-term, in the next 10 years, what are we going to see if you had a legal crystal ball? How would you see workplaces being different?
I'd like to say that I've seen it getting better all along. I have seen more sensitivity to certainly making sure that women are in leadership positions and that, narrowing the pay gap and things. And this is just one more thing in that direction, is making people more comfortable, more, frankly, respect. It's not bigger than that, though. It is about treating people equally. It's certainly equality without regard to gender. My crystal ball, what does it say? I certainly have seen, we've had the policies in place for a while. Employers have had the policies. I'm definitely seeing now more people are being trained on the policies. What I see is coming out of this Me Too movement is people are now comfortable raising it, not necessarily as a Supreme Court case, but when problems are small. I'm feeling people more comfortable saying, you know what, that's not cool. And that, to me, is a big win, is people raising it when a problem's small, certainly so that it's easier to fix at that level.
And do you think employers are responding in kind?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I guess I had this thought, and maybe I'm wrong, but interestingly, I mean, obviously discrimination on any level is bad. Gender, racial, religion, and all of those things. But for some reason, I guess I have seen that gender discrimination is a little bit more acceptable than discrimination based on all these other things. Meaning, it's okay to whistle at a woman. It's okay to say something a little bit sexually related to a woman in workplace. But we all know we can't comment on religion. We all know we can't call someone a racial slur. Am I fair in saying that it's almost as if we're so accepting of sexism that perhaps we have overlooked the fact that it's still happening?
I think that is fair. I think it probably would play out if we looked at the statistics. When I hear somebody accused of using the N-word in the workplace, or somebody that's clearly doing something that has racially derogatory connotations, there's usually a zero tolerance. When it comes to religion, that certainly was something that became zero tolerance more so recently. Whereas when it's sexual harassment, I usually hear they didn't mean it.
Yes,
or they
exactly.
Didn't recognize it, or had they known, they never would have done it. So let's give them one chance. I will say, though, my experience is you don't get two chances. I think we're more tolerant in the sense of if you made a mistake and you apologize and you learn from it and you fix it, okay, we'll let you have that one shot at remedying the situation. But certainly, I think employers are, if it happens twice, it's not going to be on my dime.
We're talking to Jill O'Brien, who is an employment lawyer. If you have any comments or questions for Jill, we're going to be talking about scenarios and what might be harassment, what might not be harassment. Give us a call here at 312-981-7200 or text to that same number. Jill, My theory, and I'm Joe Average here. I see harassment in the workplace is not the same as social awkwardness. So if some man asks you out or brings you candy, and you say no, I think that's not appropriate, or I'm not interested, but thank you. I have a boyfriend. I'm married. That's not a good idea. And he stops. That's kind of the normal situation. But if someone persists and someone keeps at it and keeps trying to corner you and keeps trying to press you, that's a whole different animal to me than social awkward dating maneuvers.
Exactly, and that's what the law says as well. And I don't want to bore you with the legal details, but in order to be unlawful, it has to be pervasive or repeated. So one time, and I'm not suggesting you get one free shot, but you sort of do get a stop, and if the person does in fact stop, then it's not going to normally rise to the level of anything that's unlawful, unless it's, you know, a severe situation. But generally, you get one chance to say, please stop. No, thank you. I don't want to go on a date with you. And as long as the behavior stops, then it's not going to be unlawful.
Now, so what is the woman's duty at the workplace when it comes, when that happens? So you have somebody who is making some advance in you that doesn't make you feel comfortable. What is your obligation, and what should a woman do?
Well, that's two different questions, right?
Yeah.
Good questions. What is your legal obligation? None. Certainly, we'd all hope that somebody would... if somebody offended you, you'd let them know. In a lot of the new policies that I'm drafting, I do specifically say you're encouraged, you're urged to say no, you're encouraged to tell the person to stop. I have some of my employer clients that will actually say red light, green light. So you're telling me a joke and it's getting a little bit over the line and I'm going to say yellow light, you're going too far. Others have really said, I need you to directly say no. Some people aren't comfortable with it, let's face it, and that's what this is really about, is the imbalance of power. I rarely see a quid pro quo, if you go out with me, I'll make sure you get a promotion. But the problem with these harassment scenarios is that it's an imbalance of power, and sometimes people don't want to take on their boss and say, you're making me uncomfortable. They'd rather ignore it. Certainly not encourage it, but not necessarily say stop. And that's where I think you get both sides. You get the alleged harasser who said, I thought you thought it was funny. I thought you liked the flirtation. Because there's nothing unlawful about the flirtation in the workplace. Certainly it may be inappropriate. It might be unprofessional. It might be a violation of a different standard of conduct. But it's not unlawful to be involved in flirting.
Right.
And
it's sort of a circular argument, because it seems to me that a normal, I'll say guy, again, gender doesn't matter here. If I just say, you know what, I'll say it in a nice way, that really doesn't make me feel uncomfortable. You got to stop that. Okay, just do you mind? No harm, no foul. Just do you mind stopping? The guy stops. You know, the abnormal guy will keep doing it. So the rules are really, I mean, for someone who's going to keep doing that, I'm not even sure that saying that would stop it. Maybe I'm wrong, but when you have a person who is hell-bent on harassing a woman at work, I don't think he cares that she's rebuffed his advances.
I think you're right in some cases.
In some cases.
In every environment, there's going to be some outliers. There's going to be some creeps, no matter
right.
what.
Right, that's what I'm talking about.
There's no doubt about that, and you can't stop that. What most employers do about that is they have alternate people to go to. So certainly they would encourage the employee to say at the time, please knock it off, that's not cool, whatever the magic phrase is that they're comfortable with. But then it is, you have alternate people to go to. You can go to your supervisor, you can go to HR, you can go to alternate people to go to, so that you know, the matter can be fixed. I think what is misunderstood a lot is if somebody does complain or say knock it off, they're not trying to get you in trouble. They're trying to just...
Have a workplace where they can do their work and focus on what they're doing.
Right. And so with the training now, and I really do think people are, you know, there's more training in the workplace, and they're training people to recognize it's not bad if somebody tells you knock it off. They really want to continue to have a good relationship with you. They're not trying to get you fired. And so what I'm seeing zero tolerance on is retaliation. So that if I tell you stop and now you say I can't say anything to you, I won't talk to you.
I won't invite you to the boardroom for the meeting because obviously you have a problem with me. And
right.
that kind
I'll
of
only
conduct.
Email you
right.
because then you won't accuse me of saying anything wrong. That's retaliation. And that is where, in fact, the law says as well that it's completely, it's you don't have to only show that you had some harm in the employment setting, but you also, retaliation is a lower standard to meet, and it would be if there's even a chilling effect that would, so I complain and then it causes you to be afraid of complaining, that would have a chilling effect in the workplace. That's the type of retaliation, and that has zero tolerance and a lot stiffer penalties, and that's where I'm seeing most employers really making a difference now. They don't tolerate that.
You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. I'm talking to Jill O'Brien, and if you have a question for her about sexual harassment, give us a call here, 312 312- 800-981-7200. And when we come back, we want to talk a little bit about some scenarios, but I also want to talk about are men justified in fearing at the workplace that they're going to be accused, and what should men be thinking about in the workplace to avoid that problem? You're listening to WGN. We're talking to Jill O'Brien about sexual harassment, and our vice president made a comment that he will never dine alone with a woman who is not his wife, and because he doesn't want to, I guess, be deemed to be harassing her in some way, or maybe he's afraid that someone is going to accuse him of that. But do men have to worry that women are going to be falsely accusing them in the workplace? I think that is a pervasive thought among men right now because of this whole Me Too movement. What do you think, Jill?
I'd be lying if I said we don't have to be cautious about it. We definitely do have to recognize that there is, we've got to watch it. I think that's extreme. I'm not going to talk about politics, obviously.
we don't want to talk about politics.
But it's
being said. And so we have to think about, is there any truth to that?
I don't think it's necessarily men alone. I happen to be in a leadership position where I am, a woman that I supervise a lot of men, so it's not exclusive to do men have to be afraid. I think people generally have to be more sensitive to what they're saying. I think that's always been the case, whether it's generationally or just people are different. They can have different opinions. Do they have to be should they be afraid? No. I think people are more sensitive. What I'm seeing more of, though, is there still is a lack of sensitivity about what is now being referred to as microaggressions. I don't know if you've heard that.
No.
More stereotypical comments. So, for example, I had a complaint where it was Super Bowl Sunday. Well, how do you know who's playing in the Super Bowl? You only care because you watch the commercials, and you're a woman, and you don't. You don't really care about the game, or you're only looking, at Tom Brady's behind. You're not looking at anything else. That's a microaggression, any of these stereotypical comments. I think now people are sensitive to don't smack somebody on the behind, whatever Katie Couric said. I don't hear about those allegations, but I am hearing more of these insensitive, stereotypical comments that really have to go away.
And again, there seems to be somewhat of a thin line between just being kind of ignorant and careless and being intentionally harmful to people. I mean,
there is, although under the law, intent is irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, I am frequently the only woman in a room. When all the men come in, they shake hands, but yet they want to hug me. They don't mean to be rude or insensitive or sexist. At first it was awkward, and then it just became stick out your hand and shake their hand, and they know the Latin kind. A lot of times people don't know what to do, and that's where you asked, should people be afraid? I don't think people should be afraid, but I think they are.
Yeah.
I think we're all afraid of going too far to the other extreme as well. I have men that say, is it okay if I open the door for you? At what point does it stop?
It's just common politeness and courtesy, and I love that. I do that for women, and if a man does that for me, it's wonderful.
Thank you.
But then men are afraid to do that. You're so right.
But would you feel comfortable complimenting a man at work, or would one man compliment a woman if they get their hair cut?
And I suppose, to me, it's all in how it's done. There's a way to say, you look nice today, Karen, and there's a way when the eyes are going up and down saying, you look nice today. I don't know if that came across on the radio, but, sometimes as a woman, it's the same words or similar words, but it's how it's being said. It's how close someone's standing to you. It's how many times it's happened and how it makes you feel. But that's such a subjective thing, is it not?
It is. And that's why I feel personally that it's more important now than ever to tell people when they're offending you. I don't like it when you call me honey baby,
Yeah.
When 20-year-olds call me honey baby, I just think they're kind of, you know, I want to smack them. But if it's somebody that's a senior gentleman, I might not be as offended. Same words, but like you said, the different environment, different situation. But everybody has a different level of their comfort zone. And just because it's comfortable for me doesn't mean that it's comfortable for the person sitting next to me.
Absolutely. Let's go through some scenarios quickly. All right, you're at the workplace. A delivery person, a person not employed by the company, comes in and starts asking you out and bringing you candy. Is the employer responsible to stop this person's conduct if you bring it to his attention?
Absolutely, unequivocally, yes. It is the employer's obligation to keep a comfortable working environment. And that means anybody that comes in, whether it's, you know, a customer, a vendor, a postal man, whatever it is, if they offend the employee, then the employee has a right to have some action taken. Obviously, the employer can't fire the FedEx person,
right,
but you can certainly call and ask that a different person be sent out. And that is something that I think people are more sensitive to now. I think everybody gets that now.
Yes. Okay, a woman wears very short skirts and low-cut blouses to work every day. Should the employer ask her to dress more conservatively if this is maybe causing some problems or not causing some problems? And is this singling her out for discrimination?
Again, this is in a vacuum with these questions.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, there's always the extremes, but your safest bet is always going to be to point to a dress code policy, which is professional, respectful, things like that. If it's so low that it's, you know, going to cause a safety risk, then, you know, somebody's going to be unsafe and distracted. That's one thing. But I think what you're talking about is, because I wear a low-cut blouse doesn't mean I'm inviting you to flirt with me. It just means it's a comfortable blouse. And the way to deal with that is, across the board consistently, it's not professional. Do you mind one button more, whatever it is, in terms of dress code and professionalism?
Got it. So what about an employee who is a Christian, very devout Christian, and his view is that gay marriage is wrong, and he doesn't want to recognize gay marriages in the workplace, and he's not going to call that person your spouse or your husband or whatever. If that person is espousing those types of opinions, is that creating some sort of hostile work environment?
It could be. Certainly for somebody who was gay, they might be offended by that. And also in Cook County and in Chicago and under Illinois law, sexual preference, sexual orientation is a legally protected category. So it's not only, you know, it would be unlawful to treat somebody who's gay different than somebody who's straight, but it also could create a hostile environment if somebody were made to feel uncomfortable based on their sexual orientation.
And everyone's going to say, yes, and people out there, Jill, are going to be saying, well, what about his First Amendment right?
Which would be in the context of public employment, but private employers don't have that same standard. You know, certainly the Constitution is alive and well, the First Amendment is alive and well, but when you're dealing with those kinds of issues, it's a balancing. And my right to espouse my views about my religious preference are going to be secondary to your right to be comfortable at work. So certainly I can talk about things until it makes you uncomfortable, and that's where it has to stop and where an employer will need to step in.
I hear this all the time, Jill. People call me and say, my boss is a maniac. He swears all the time. And I say, does he do it to just women or just men or just Jewish people or African-American people? No, he's like that with everybody. He's creating a hostile work environment. Is that a hostile work environment?
You know, what you're getting at is an equal opportunity offender, right?
Right. So he's an equal opportunity jerk. He doesn't single out anyone for any reason.
Right.
He treats everyone equally crummy.
You know, with those facts that you just gave, it's possible he is simply a jerk and an ineffective boss, and he probably is unprofessional and disrespectful and should be fired. Under the law, unless you're treating somebody different because of a legally protected category or making somebody uncomfortable, so if you're treating them different in terms of a tangible decision, that would be employment discrimination. Harassment is making them uncomfortable at work based on a legally protected category. That's the hostile environment. I'm mean, I'm yelling at everybody. That's generally not going to be unlawful harassment. That's probably just going to be bullying, which is not presently unlawful, although I think it will be in our lifetime.
Interesting, because people have a very strong concept that they have to be treated fairly at work, and they have to be like their boss, and their boss has to be nice to them, and that if their boss is not courteous to them, they have some cause of action, and that really just isn't the case. And like you said, maybe bullying will become a, you know, some sort of protected know, maybe a person has a right not to be bullied at the workplace, but we're not there yet.
We're not. And I could literally say to you every time I see you in the morning, I was hoping you would not make it through the night. You're my worst employee I've ever had. I wish you didn't walk in today. When are you going to quit? That makes me a bully, but it doesn't make me somebody who's engaged in unlawful harassment unless I've done it based on a legally protected category. Again, it might be unprofessional, inappropriate, et cetera. But the law's real clear on that. People don't always understand that part.
Jill O'Brien, thank you for joining us. If people want to get a hold of you, how would they contact you?
So at Lehner Mutian, 312-467-9800. Our website is www.lehnermutian.com.
And you can always contact me and get Jill's information. Thank you. And well, join me next year on Academy Awards Sunday, and maybe we'll see what the crystal ball holds.
Right.
All right. You're listening to the Karen Conti Show on WGN. It's Karen Conti here on a March evening, in like a lion, out like a lamb. I think we're still in the lion phase. But I want to wish everybody a happy National Grammar Day. I love looking up those national days. Today's National Grammar Day, and I guess that means we're supposed to be speaking in perfect grammar. Ain't that great? Interestingly, as a lawyer, we have to really speak well. We are supposed to speak well. And as a radio person, I'm really supposed to speak well. And I don't always use everything correctly. But and when I don't, our listeners really usually let me know. But it's an interesting thing. Being a lawyer, we're very much judged on how we talk, how we write. And it's very important for us to be clear. Even though there's a lot of joking about how we use legalese, I think that most lawyers don't use it anymore. I know I don't use it, the wherefores and the heretofores. It just doesn't make sense, and it's not persuasive. And it's always good to have good grammar and to know what words to use. And if I don't do it all the time, you know, shame on me. Anyway, this is the time for you to call in with legal questions. I'm a practicing lawyer. I've been practicing for over 30 years, and I've practiced in a lot of different areas. I don't know everything about everything, but I usually know enough to be able to answer part of your question or maybe refer you to somebody or to somewhere where you might get an answer to your question. So give us a call here, 312-981-7200, and you'll also be texting to that same number, 981-7200. There's all kinds of areas of family law, contract law. Was there a news story that you read about that you have a question? Did one of our guests say something that might have been interesting and you have a comment and a question? 981-7200. And while I'm waiting for the phone lines to fill up, which I hope they will, I wanted to give out my number and my contact information at the office. Not everybody is looking for a lawyer all the time, but when you do need a lawyer and something arises, it's always good to have a name. And again, if I can't handle your case, or if I don't practice in that area, or I don't practice in the county where you live, I can usually find you somebody who I know or has a reputation of being a good attorney, so you don't have to go to the yellow pages or start Googling, which is really not a good way to pick a lawyer. So I'm going to give that information out. I'm always happy to get your emails and your calls. 312-332-7800. That's at the office. Put that on your cell phone. Wouldn't that be a good idea to have under a lawyer, so you know if your friend needs a divorce lawyer or a criminal lawyer, you can always call me for a referral. 312-332-7800 or K Conti. Actually, I'm going to give you the WGN one. It's WGN at kcontilaw.com. WGN at I'm sorry. I got it wrong. I had a mix of it. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. One more time. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. Thank you, Jerry. My husband is correcting me, as he usually does. Anyway, give us a call here. We're taking your legal questions. I got an email a couple weeks ago that was interesting, and it's something that I hear all the time. A gentleman emailed me and said, I have a small painting business. A disgruntled employee who I fired for drinking on the job is now posting horrible, untrue complaints on my website, posing as a customer. I feel this will destroy my business. What can I do to sue him? Well, this is really a difficult thing, because do you have a right to have things, do you have a right for people not to say untrue things about you. Yes, you do. It's defamation. If somebody says something that is untrue and it's a fact and it adversely impacts your profession, that's really a simple way of describing defamation. If it's just an opinion, like I think you're a bad painter, or I don't think you do a good job, or I think you're terrible. Those are more like opinions. But if it's something specific, I hired a lawyer and she missed the deadline and she caused me $100,000 worth of losses. That would be a statement. And if it were untrue, that would be actionable, meaning you have a right to bring a lawsuit. But just because you have a right to bring a lawsuit doesn't mean you can afford it. And it doesn't mean that it's cost effective. And these cases that I see with internet comments that are damaging, and boy, are they damaging to businesses. I know they are. And it's not that I'm downplaying how they can affect your business. I've seen businesses go out for these kinds of things, whether it's an employee or a disgruntled customer or just some weirdo who decides that they don't like you. That becomes a problem, because bringing a lawsuit, I mean, just filing it and serving it is probably $400 or $500 in fees. Then in expenses, and then you have a lawyer who you're going to be paying $200, $300, $400 an hour to fight, and these cases could take hundreds of hours, and you're talking about hundreds of maybe $50,000, $100,000, maybe $250,000 worth of attorney's fees. So the thing I usually tell people is to tell them to cease and desist, do it in writing. And maybe you hire a lawyer to write a letter, a very strong letter, saying you are responsible for loss of business. If you do this again, we will exercise our rights to pursue anything that is within the law. And sometimes people stop and sometimes people don't. But it's a question I'm getting a lot, and it's a hard one to solve, because there's no cheap and easy or fast way to get some results. Again, let me give out the numbers here. It's 312-981-7200, or text to 981-7200. Let's go to Jess. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Do you have a legal problem?
Actually, I have a legal question.
Sure.
There's a woman across the street from me. She has four dogs, and I had a question. How many dogs in Illinois can a person have?
That's a good question. And I think it's going to be more in a city by city. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. And I don't know what city you're in.
I'm sorry, Joliet.
You're in Joliet. Okay. I can easily find that answer for you. There's probably a city code that deals with that. And it should be easy to find. I'll bet if you call the city, I know that Joliet, I've dealt with them, and they're pretty responsive when you call them. They're pretty friendly there still. And, you know, it's not so big a courthouse, or so big, a city hall where they, you might want to just maybe talk to somebody in the legal department, or someone in the housing department, and see if you can get that answer. If not, you know, email me and I'll get it for you. Okay? Email me. Sure, it's the easy one to remember, but so easy that I can't remember it. It is WGN@AskKarenConti.com. WGN@AskKarenConti.com. All right? All right. Thank you. Give us a call. The phone lines are open if you have a legal question. Let's go to, that's the 219 area code. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show. Oop. Cash, do we still have the caller? Oh, hello. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
You know, we've got into one of those timeshare exits that was advertised on WGN, and gave them $6,000. And we haven't heard a thing. I think we got took. Is there any kind of recourse for that?
You know, I really can't comment on that, because I don't know what they promised to do, and I don't know what your contract says.
Well, they promised to get you out of the timeshare, as far as the payments and stuff for the timeshare, or the, you know, to get you out of that contract.
Okay.
And every time we call, they always have somebody that will take your call, but it's just been a stall thing. And I had called Cochran, you know, because that's, you know, where I'm listening to him going to work every day. And when I called him, he gave me a contact guy, and I called that guy, and I've never gotten a response.
Okay, you know what? You know what we're going to do? Why don't you send me an email and let me see if I can get somebody there. And, you know, again, I don't know the contract. I don't know what it says. There's probably some small print that talks about difficult situations. I know these timeshares are very hard to get out of. I know there are people that advertise that they can do it. But before I start saying things on air, I really would like to read that and then make contact myself and see if I can help you out, okay? So the email is probably the best way to reach me, because then you can tell me who you are. I will remember who you are, and I can get back to you. And if you can scan the contract, that would be very helpful, too, and give me the name of any person with whom you've had contact. That email address is WGN at AskKarenConti.com. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. We're going to take a break here, but we're going to come back and answer some more legal questions. Please give me a call. We have phone lines open, 312-981-7200. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
On this side of the law, on that side of the law, who is right, who is wrong, who is for and who's against the law? Well, you see, I didn't really mean you any harm.
We're talking law here on the Karen Conti Show. This is your opportunity to talk to a practicing lawyer and ask me questions about anything you want. Family law. Do you have child support issues? Do you have contract issues? Do you have neighborhood disputes? A lot of those going on. Give me a call, and I'll try my best to answer them. 312-981-7200. And while I'm waiting for the phone lines to get filled up here, I'll give out my number at the office in case you want to call me and ask me something off air. The best thing to do is to email me, because then you can tell me where you live, where this incident happened, or where the dispute arose, how long ago it happened. A lot of times things are past the time deadlines, the statutes of limitations, so that's important. And tell me what your problem is and what you expect and what you want to do. And you can put all those facts together for me as quickly as you can. That email address is WGN at AskKarenConti.com. WGN at AskKarenConti.com. And you're giving, we got callers lined up, but Jerry, my husband, who's a loyal listener, well, he has to come to the show, and he had a question about sexual harassment as you were sitting there listening to our prior interview. Jerry, what was your question?
My question is simply this. You know, I understand that, first of all, let me just point out my position. I'm totally against this sort of thing, harassment in any way, shape, or form. And I tend to think that a woman may falsely accuse someone maybe one in a thousand times. However, who's ever being accused, whether it's a man or a woman, they seem to, in this political environment, to have no due process. Boom, you're out the door without any proof, without any adjudication from a court of law. That kind of rubs me the wrong way. Again, it's probably an infinitesimal problem, but it makes me uneasy.
But I think a lot of people are saying those words. And again, due process, you know, technical due process from a legal standpoint has to do with mostly the criminal justice system, where you're accused of a crime and there has to be due process before you lose some right, whether it's liberty or money and that type of thing. So that's not the right term, but I understand what you're saying. A woman could say anything about a man in a workplace and get him fired, and the man doesn't have really any rights to a formal process by which he can defend himself. Now, what Jill O'Brien, our last guest, does, she will do an investigation. If a woman, say, makes a complaint against a man, she will probably take them both out of the workplace, and she probably will do an investigation, ask other women, have they had this happen to them? What's your proof? Did you send an email to him that confirmed that you didn't like what was going on? Talking to everyone, getting both sides of it, and then coming up with a report and also a plan on what to do. Maybe these people need to be separated. Maybe he needs to be fired. Maybe she needs to be, maybe it's not something that rises to the level. So there is some process in the workplace usually, or there should be, but there's no formal right to any adjudication before someone fires you, because we're employees at will, unless you're in a union contract or you have a very serious contract, which most people don't in the workplace, you really are at the whim of the employer. And if the employer says, I think you did it, you know, and maybe you don't like the proof and there is no proof, the employer still has a right to fire you. So that's kind of a, not a great answer, but that's what happens. Thank you, Terry. Appreciate your listening. All right, here we go. Let's go to the phones. Let us go to David. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. Can you hear me okay?
I hear you perfectly.
Great. Calling for a friend. This is something that happened a few years ago. It's still pending for him. I think he answered an ad for someone looking to looking for funds to invest, and he thought it'd be a good deal at the time. He contacted this person, I think, only via email, maybe a phone conversation. My friend himself, who's not an attorney or doesn't have good investment decision-making maybe, thought it was a great idea. He wrote up a contract himself, a few pages long, about the amounts and the dates of what he was willing to invest and how much he should get in return within a given time frame. And if after a year, I think, he got nothing or it wasn't as promised and agreed to, then he had his had to get his full number of thousands of dollars back at the end of that. So he's only exchanged emails and phone conversations with this person ongoing for a few years now. Never seen any money. I think he even sent her more later. What he wrote up was signed by each of them and notarized.
Okay.
I think they exchanged photocopies of their driver's licenses as well.
Let me ask
you. He's kind of at a loss for what he could
okay.
do.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Was and I don't want names or anything like that, but was this a company or is this a person on the contract? Is it a name of a corporation, a Inc. or LLC, or is it the name of the individual?
I'm pretty sure it's just the individual. I think they had plans to start a company, or maybe they had a company name in mind. I didn't get
okay.
the sense that they were incorporated. I read this document, but not recently, and I have a copy of it.
Okay, David, I'm just going to talk a little bit generally for people general, and then I'm going to address this issue in particular. Generally speaking, when you enter into a contract, you know, the terms are enforceable. Surely it's written and it's signed, so they're enforceable. The problem is, and I'll say this a million times on this show, sometimes you have an absolute right to win your case and that there is a breach of contract and this person may have breached the contract clearly. And maybe you take that person to court and you file the lawsuit for breach of contract and you find out she was a fly-by-night person. She took the money and never even tried to get the business started. Let's just say that happens and you get a judgment against this woman for $100,000 or whatever the investment was. The problem is collecting it. Because this woman, if she's a scam artist or she took the money and lost it somehow, she may not have the money. If she doesn't have the money to pay back, she may not pay the judgment. And there's a lot of people who don't care if they have a judgment against them. You then have to garnish wages. You then have to put liens on bank accounts. You have to put liens on cars and houses. It's very time intensive to collect. So I think the first thing your friend should do is to make the demand for the money and then say you're a breach of contract, I'm going to hire a lawyer. And that person, David, is going to have to hire a lawyer and try to assert rights and try to get the money back, hopefully without litigation, because again, litigation is extremely expensive, and again, at the end of it, you might have a judgment, but no way to actually collect on that judgment. But have your friend give me a call or an email, and I'm happy to help him out or at least guide him a little bit more in the right direction. That number is 312-332-7800, and it's WGN at AskKarenConti.com. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the very interesting case of the city of Chicago settling for $20 million two families who lost loved ones in a car crash caused by a drunken off-duty police officer. We're talking to the plaintiff's lawyers when we come back, and then we're going to be taking more of your calls. Again, 312-981-7200. You're listening to WGN. Karen Conti Show. This week, the city of Chicago agreed to pay $20 million to the families of two men who were killed when a drunk off-duty police officer struck their car. Detective Joseph Frugali had blood alcohol levels four times the legal limit and is now serving 8 years in prison downstate. Joining me to talk about this case and why the city is paying for the acts of off-duty police officers is nationally recognized personal injury attorney Tim Cavanaugh. Welcome to the show. Hi, Tim.
Thank you, Karen. Good to be here.
We also have other two lawyers who were involved in the case, Mike Sorge and Kevin Conway, and I'm going to put light up their microphones here, too. Hi. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Thanks, Karen.
Good. Congratulations on your settlement for the families of these two gentlemen. Let's start with what happened. What was the accident like, Tim? What happened to these two men?
So on April 10th, 2009, these two young men, Andrew was 23, Fausto was 21, they were driving home, headed southbound on the Dan Ryan. They had a flat tire. The tire actually disintegrated, went up into the electrical system, so they didn't have any means to drive the car or have any lights. But they were able to get the car off to the side of the road on the Dan Ryan, just south of Roosevelt Road, just where that entrance ramp is. And they were in the best spot. It was dark out. It was the middle of the night, after 3 in the morning, but it was a well-lit area with artificial lighting. And this off-duty police officer, Joe Frugali, who had been at a number of bars, including Dugan's, was four times the legal limit, came down that ramp and plowed into the rear of this car. That car started on fire, and these two young men burned to death.
Tragic accident. And you sued the Chicago Police Department and Frugali, is that correct?
We did.
Okay. And what your theory was that even though Frugali was off duty at the time, he wasn't in uniform, correct?
That's correct. He was driving his own car.
He was driving his own car. And by what theory, from a legal standpoint, do you hold someone responsible, hold the city responsible for someone who's not on the clock?
Yeah, it's based on a Supreme Court decision, the Monell decision, but it's all based on the code of silence that's here in the city of Chicago that's been acknowledged by Mayor Emanuel. It's an unwritten rule of protecting fellow officers for their bad acts. And we know from going to Joe Frugali's criminal sentencing hearing that he had a horrible history of bad acts. He was an alcoholic. When you talk about Joe Frugali, you have to realize two things. One, he was a Chicago cop, and two, he was an alcoholic. And he used to drink and drive in city proper, and he knew he could get away with it if he was ever pulled over by a city cop. And we know that because we discovered evidence in this case that it had happened on multiple occasions, and I'm happy to talk about those examples.
Well, yeah, let's talk a little bit about it, and I want to get some of your other co-plaintiff lawyers here. Kevin, just give me a sampling of what happened in this guy's past that maybe should have had him off the street.
Well, first of all, he has been a very serious drinker, 15 to 20 drinks 3 to 4 times a week. He's been doing that since he was 16 years old. He did that again and again. He drank with fellow police officers. He was drunk. He drove drunk every night that he drank. So what we have is someone who was stopped a number of times. He actually struck a police car and injured two policemen one night at 5 a.m., and they never even took any field sobriety tests of him. This is somebody who was given a pass again and again. And our theory was that the city enabled him, that is the police department, enabled him by not taking action.
So the idea was, like, on any of these given occasions, had he been given a breathalyzer, he may have, you know, been incarcerated, or at least maybe he may have gone to rehab and stopped drinking, so that by giving him a pass, not even as a, I mean, as he was a police officer, and obviously they were doing that to protect one of their own, but they were giving a pass to someone who was then going to go out and do this, not just on Chicago police time, but on his own time. And so we basically, the city freed him to do that.
Yes, it's even worse than that. The city withheld evidence from us. And during the trial, it came out that the city knew that he had committed a few felonies one night at a tavern on the south side in Bridgeport, where he beat up one person, he threw one across the bar. He broke property, and then when the police came and told him to stay still, he got in the car and drove away. There was a police chase. They got him, and the first thing he did is he pulled out his badge and says, I'm a police officer. Somehow, mysteriously, the charges were dropped. He was given 5 days off after the internal investigation. And those documents were withheld from us. We found them during the trial.
Tim, the case went to trial, and you tried the whole case, and the case settled somewhere in the trial. What prompted it to settle so quickly?
We were in the middle of closing argument. I was actually just got done with my liability argument. It was almost 2 hours. I switched over to told the jury, now I want to talk about the damages in this case. The city at that point asked for a sidebar. Judge Kendall pulled us over. We talked about it, and we now know that the excess insurance carrier, it wasn't just City of Chicago money. I live in the city. I'm not happy that my tax dollars are going to pay this, but they had insurance through one of these national carriers, and that excess carrier stepped in, and they offered us $20 million.
So they maybe saw which way the wind was blowing on this, you know.
They knew it was going to be a bad verdict.
Mike Sorich, you were a state's attorney. You were a prosecutor before you started working for plaintiffs in these kinds of cases. Tell me about the code of silence a little bit. Is it? I take it it's not just Chicago. This is not a unique to Chicago scenario, correct?
That's correct, Karen. It happens in every city across the United States. And it's when other officers cover up for the bad acts of those few officers. You know, certainly the code of silence doesn't affect every single police officer. We're certainly not saying every police officer is a bad officer, but in situations where this does come up and misconduct does occur, it's particularly important when you're dealing with the police department and you're giving officers you're giving them a gun, you're giving them a badge, they're given very important powers that they can take away someone's life. You know, they can lock someone up and incarcerate them. So with those great powers, there's some responsibility. And that's what this case was about, was being able to identify Joe Fregoli early on in his career and discipline him so that this tragic event didn't occur.
Is there something unique to police officers? And I always think in my head as an analogy, we are lawyers and we are, you know, bound together because we've all gone to law school and we have similar experiences and maybe we even have similar outlooks on things. But when lawyers do bad things, we have a duty to report them. And if we don't report something significant that a lawyer has done that was wrong, unethical, we are responsible. And our licensing commission has held us responsible for those types of things. But I don't know that I see lawyers covering up to the extent that I hear police officers cover up. But again, I have friends who are police officers. I think it's one of the most difficult jobs, especially now in this climate. And I don't want this to be a, you know, we're crucifying all Chicago police officers. But is there something unique to being a police officer that makes you cover for your buddy? Tim, is that?
Well, I think it comes down to culture. I mean, we as lawyers, we have a duty to disclose misconduct by other lawyers. The Supreme Court has recognized that. But the culture of the Chicago Police Department, I can only speak to that because we did a lot of depositions in this case. And the culture in the city of Chicago is that they're going to cover for the bad acts. You can't find a memo or a document from the CPD that tells the fellow officers to do it. But we uncovered numerous examples in this case where police officers, not just Joe Fregoli, but other police officers would drive drunk and they knew they could get away with it because if they were pulled over by another CPD officer, they were going to be given a pass.
You know, it just seems to me, too, it's probably more, I don't know what the word is, but if you're riding around in a car and you've got a partner, you know, you're protecting that partner's life because on any given day, as we know with some of the recent tragedies and the shootings of police officers, that your day could be your last. And so you rely upon that person to protect you. And I would imagine that protection goes beyond what most people do to protect a coworker because it's life or death, whereas my job is generally not life or death. So do you think that this case and all the money that was paid out, and a lot of angry people, even Rahm Emanuel, said, I don't think money should have been going to this. It seems like a, you know, waste of money and waste of taxpayer dollars. You're representing the families. You have to do what you do, and you did it successfully. Do you think, though, that this is going to be a lesson to the city, another lesson, yet another one, so that we change the culture and we change the procedures and we change what's happening. Is this something that is positive for the city?
I think so. My clients think so. It was important that in evidence we put in this case. You know, Mayor Emanuel has taken a step that no other mayor did before. He publicly acknowledged that there's a code of silence. We played the videotape of his speech to the city council, to the jury. It was powerful evidence in this case. So the first thing, when you want to change the culture of an organization, you got to admit there was a problem. So the mayor should be applauded for actually publicly acknowledging this problem. Now, the more difficult thing is changing the culture of the CPD. But, you know, the mayor had his own public accountability task force, and then the Justice Department came in. But he should be applauded for having this task force that also has acknowledged this problem. And he's taken that first step.
And that's a good thing. And I'm a firm believer, and a lot of people don't like lawyers, you know, getting big verdicts, and it costs everyone money, and why do they need the money? These are two young men just basically, you know, murdered in the prime of their life. And I think that if nothing changes social and governmental wrongdoing, it's money. It's just money. It's people getting angry, having to pay it. I mean, how much in wrongful death cases do we have? That half a billion dollars, I think, in the last 10 years or so. The numbers are staggering. And so instead of complaining about paying out that money, maybe we should be changing so we don't have these cases in the future. That's my little opinion there. But, well, thank you for joining me, Tim Kavanaugh, Mike Sorge, and Kevin Conway. Congratulations, and keep up the good work.
Thank you, Karen.
You're listening to WGN. It's the Karen Conti Show.
Your lawyer called and said he had the papers all prepared. To sign my name was all I had to do.
Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. Hey, this is your last opportunity to get your legal calls in and give out the numbers 312-981-7200 or text me 981-7200. I'll be happy to answer your questions in the next 10 minutes, so get them in and the phone lines are open. If you don't reach me here and you want to talk to me personally, you can always call me at the office 312-332-7800. Or you can email me your question, which is always nice, and that's wgn@askkarenconti.com. Give us a call here. The phone lines are open. Let me, I had a call last week from a woman who said that she had taken her dog into a vet because he wasn't eating and wasn't acting right. And the vet didn't diagnose the situation and gave some medicine to the dog. And when the situation didn't improve, the dog was brought to another vet in the city who x-rayed him and found a rubber toy in his intestines and operated. I want to sue my vet, she said. So the question is, you know, do you have a right to sue over veterinarian malpractice? And certainly you do. But the problem, again, and I feel like a broken record on this, the question is, was the vet negligent? Did the vet failure to x-ray the dog with the symptoms that the dog had, was that negligence? And would a vet of proper training and in the area do the same thing? Or was it against the standard of care, we call it? And if it is, then there's a liability. But in this case, we have two problems. One is the dog did have an operation, and the dog survived, and the dog was fine. And there's no evidence that the dog was any worse off having had this misdiagnosis. In fact, it was fortunate that this person brought the dog in to another vet who did do the right thing. So even though the vet may have done the wrong thing, there was no harm that was really provable in that type of case. And the second problem is, unfortunately, we all love our animals. Sometimes we love our animals more than we love people. I just hate to say it, but it's true. And you wouldn't take any money for the life of your dog. But when it comes to a jury and when it comes to trying a case, it's hard to get people motivated to give out huge amounts of damages for the loss of a dog or a cat or any other pet. So the problem is finding a lawyer who's going to take your case, maybe on a contingency, and then at the end of the day not get much in recovery. So you probably would have a hard time getting a lawyer to take that case. So interesting, though, because people are very upset about these types of things, and I understand that. Give us a call here. We've got a few minutes left, 981-7200. Jim, welcome to the show. Thank you for holding. Hi.
This is Jim. I'm going through a divorce, and my wife and I met with an attorney, but the lawyer said that he would only represent one of us, and it's an amicable divorce, but I'm an over-the-road, I own a semi, and I'm an over-the-road driver, and her attorney is saying for alimony that I need to give 30% of all the money I bring in, and that my costs for fuel and depreciation on the vehicle and things like that don't matter. And I was just wondering if that's the case, because about 60% of the income I bring in goes towards expenses.
There's a few parts of your question that I want to address. First of all, that lawyer's correct. A lot of people come to me, I do family law, and say, I want, you know, you to represent both me and my husband. And that, it doesn't work. It's sort of like a baseball team. You can't play on both sides because there's always going to be issues that you need to advise your client of, and that would be maybe harmful to the other side, like, you know, on issues of child support or issues of maintenance or property division. So you do need to get your own lawyers, and that doesn't mean that the divorce can't be amicable, because good lawyers who are very collaborative and maybe have some good negotiation and mediation skills can get these things done with the least amount of court intervention. So that's just a little advice about that. As to the issue of maintenance, we now have a new law, fairly new in the last couple of years, that maintenance is what we used to call alimony, which is support to a spouse, not child support, but support to a spouse. So let's just say that one party is making $100,000, and maybe the mother might be a stay-at-home mother, and so she's been out of the workforce and maybe only working part-time. The statute says that if there's a maintenance obligation, that the payer, meaning you, Jim, would have to pay 30% of his gross minus 20% of her gross. And that's the maintenance amount. And then there is also a formula for how long you would have to pay that, and that depends on how lengthy your marriage is. So the greater number of years you've been married, the longer your obligation might be. So we need to take a look at that statute. The statute also provides that it's income from all sources. So the question is, do you take your business expenses off the top of that? And my best read on that, again, without knowing all the facts, would be that you should be able to take your gas and your actual out-of-pocket expenses off of that, because you have to pay those. And so that money is not going into your pocket, and it's not benefiting you or the family. So it would be fair to take off those necessary expenses. I'm not sure if it would be fair to take off depreciation, because depreciation is more of a book deduction. It's not a really out-of-pocket deduction. Do you see what I'm saying? So if you're paying for the truck, yes, but if it's being depreciated and that is a subtraction, that probably won't be factored in when it comes to determining what your income is. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's actually the way I was explaining it to her, that, yeah, I could see adding back in the depreciation, but the expenses there, I don't see that money, or I do see the depreciation money.
Right. And that's my best advice to you, but I'm sure you'll have a good lawyer and someone who's going to get this done amicably for you. Jim, thanks for the call. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us, Cash. Thank you for being a great producer. Jerry, my husband, always glad you were out there watching me pull or plunge today and taking pictures of me, because this might be a one-time shot. I'm not sure. Although, you know, there was such good energy out there. Never say never. Thank you for listening. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN.